Okay, if you have your Bible, if you want to open up to 1 Samuel, I'm going to continue on in our study in the book of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel 14 is where we are. The story thus far is that Saul has been anointed king. It's the first time Israel has had a king. They've moved now from a theocracy to a monarchy. God is teaching Israel valuable lessons through the process of this. And when we started chapter 13, the implication was the first couple years of Saul's reign as king wasn't that big of a deal. Nothing much happened. But in the second year of his reign, his son Jonathan, more than likely under Saul's command, went and attacked a garrison of the Palestinians, the Philistines. And it was an unprovoked attack, but it was basically kind of an attack saying, we're not going to take this anymore. We're tired of being under your thumb. We're our own sovereign nation, so, you know, back off. And so what this did, it didn't really hurt the Palestinians. All it did was make them mad. And so they gathered together a huge army. The text tells us that it was 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen. The numbers are a little odd in that. There are some manuscripts that actually say 3,000 chariots, which would make a little bit more sense. But either way, it's a big army that's coming up against Israel. Israel, who has no advanced technology. We found out at the end of the last chapter, the only people that even have, you know, even have armor, have swords and stuff, are the royalty within Israel right now. Everybody else apparently is running around without anything, you know, pitchforks and shovels and stuff, and they're going to try to fight a battle this way. So bottom line is, Saul had gathered together, had built himself a standing army of about 3,000 men, and when this army from the Palestinians gets together, it's huge, numbers more than, you know, it looks like the sands of the seashore, all the men that are arrayed against them, and they're encamped in the valley there outside of Gilgal, or Gibeah, and they're encamped in the valley waiting to come down and take Saul out. And so Saul gathers his guys together there at Gibeah or in Gilgal. I can't remember where he was. Does it really matter? It doesn't matter. Anyway, the point is that he's gathering with his men. His army of 3,000 dwindles down. They're just deserting left and right. I mean, you know, every night they go to bed, they wake up and there's less guys there at roll call, and it's a mess. So his army is draining away before his very eyes. The odds against him are just incredible. And he was told to wait for Samuel. Samuel said wait for him for 7 days and he would be there. And the implication is he'd be there and they'd do sacrifices to the Lord and go out in the Lord's power. Well, he waited around, and it looks like he got to the end of the seventh day, and he didn't see Samuel showing up, and so he took matters into his own hand. We learned a lot from that, how he took his religion into his own hands, and he began doing the burnt offerings himself. And of course, right as he was finished doing this, which he wasn't supposed to do, only a priest was supposed to do, Samuel shows up and says, what have you done? And so they have this confrontation between them, and at that moment, Samuel says to him, basically, that the kingdom is being taken from you. You messed up here. You showed that you weren't worthy of trusting the Lord, that your heart isn't towards the Lord. And the Lord is at this time, right at that moment, began making his selection of the new king, of the king that was going to be after his own heart. And so Samuel takes off, and we're not told as to what happened there, but Samuel takes off and Saul is left there, and they're left there, and that's kind of where the story left off last time. They're left facing this huge army that's arrayed against them, and you know, the thing is looking dire for them because they don't even have that much weaponry among them. So 1 Samuel 14, we'll pick up in verse 1. Now it happened one day that Jonathan, son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, come on, let's go over to the Philistine garrison that's on the other side. But he didn't tell his father. And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah. Okay, he's in Gibeah, that's what I thought. Okay, under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were there, or who were with him, were about 600 men. Abiah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing an ephod, but the people didn't know that Jonathan had gone. All right, I love how this little vignette starts out here. This is like, you know, one day, Jonathan said to this guy, let's go do this. You know, he said to his armor bearer, You know, it's an interesting speculation on these armor bearers, you know, the armor bearers that were with them. Oftentimes we're thinking in terms of medieval armor bearers. They would be guys who were kind of in charge of a knight's armor and who would help him in assembling his vast array of weaponry around him as he would go off and do battle and different deeds. But in the ancient context here, we think that it may be a little bit different. In fact, there's some compelling evidence to indicate that these armor bearers, these shield bearers, were much more than just a guy who was looking after the armor, that there was a fighting style associated with it where the armor bearer and the swordsman would work together in tandem in a unique and kind of intricate fighting style. Just a little aside that I thought was interesting, but anyway, so this tandem fighting style is kind of puts them together as a little commando team, basically. So Jonathan decides it's time for, you know, a kind of a look-see. Let's go look around and see what's going on over here. He doesn't come right out and say what it is that, you know, they're going to do over there, but he said, let's go over to the garrison. It's an outpost. It's a lookout point over there by where the camp is of the Palestinians, who are camped out in array against the Israelites. And so basically he's saying, let's go, you know, check these guys out. Let's go see what's going on. And you note here that he doesn't tell his father about this. He's going to go do this. It's an interesting thing here as we look at this. Here's Jonathan, and obviously he's getting tired of waiting as well. I mean, there's this sense of anticipating this doom that's looming over them. There's, you know, terrible, terrible circumstances facing them in the valley. And he's tired of just sitting around there. That's the implication anyway. I'm kind of elaborating on it. Tired of just sitting around waiting for the Palestinians to come down on them and destroy them. He says, let's go take a look at it. Let's go scout this out. Let's see what's going on here. The implication being, let's kind of see what the Lord's up to. Maybe see where God's at work here. And verse 3 gives us this real contrast here because, you know, it says he doesn't tell his father about it. And in verse 3, we see that Jonathan's going out to scout out the enemy and see what's going on while Saul is sitting under a tree. It's interesting that when Saul should have been waiting before, remember, as I explained in the last chapter, he was supposed to wait for Samuel. When he should have been waiting, he couldn't wait. He couldn't sit still. He went out and he did something. Now, when he's in a situation and the situation actually calls for his activity, we find that he's not doing anything. He's sitting under a tree waiting for the Palestinians to either come down and destroy them or starve them out, where his son is actually out doing something. So, you know, now when he's supposed to be busy, he's not doing anything. When he should be repenting and showing some bravery, he's just sitting around. These are discomfitting signs about his character, about Saul's character. This is troubling when we look at this as signs of what's going on in his life. It's an interesting thing here that Ichabod would have been mentioned in here. You know, some could look at this, and it is a strange thing that this is even mentioned. It really has nothing to do with the bit of text in the passage. I mean, he's sitting under a tree, but then all of a sudden they start mentioning the people of the former priesthood that are associated with him here still. Ichabod is there. And of course, remember, Ichabod was a part of Eli's household, born to Phinehas' wife when he died. Remember the whole story there? And she named him Ichabod because the glory, in her estimation, the glory had departed from Israel. It was the time when the ark was taken away. So the concept of the glory has departed is now being associated, and we think that this is deliberate on the narrator's part. He's deliberately associating Ichabod, the glory departing, with Saul now. Ichabod is there dwelling with Saul. There's this sense of, you know, like a vulture hanging over Saul's shoulder. His doom is being forecast in all of this. And so that's why he would have been associated with there. The narrator's trying to give us hints as to where this story is going. Now, it says there that the people didn't know that Jonathan was going to go attack the garrison alone, which is another interesting contrast here, or if not a contrast, at least something that indicates something about Jonathan's character, because Jonathan and his armor bearer are off doing this deed on their own. They're off taking an assessment of the situation to see where the Lord is at work, and they're not making a big deal about it. They didn't grandstand this. He didn't ride to the Israelite camp and say, hey, we're going to go out and do something here and stir everybody to enjoy them or praise them. He did this simply as an act of bravery before the Lord, just a boldness in God. No interest in trying to draw attention to himself in this. Nobody even knew he was gone at the moment. So this wasn't anything done for glory or for any other ulterior motive other than to see if the Lord was up to something. And the reason I keep saying to see if the Lord is up to something is because of how the narrative goes on. We'll see how this works out. So verse 4. Between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other side. And the name of one was Bozetz, and the name of the other was Seneh. And the front one faced northward opposite Michmash, and the other one southward towards Gibeah. Now, this almost is like out of Lord of Rings or something. I mean, you know, they're naming rocks, nice. But what's happening here? This is a little bit of a detail that's important for us to be able to put together in our mind's eye how this is all going to go down. As Jonathan's on his way out there, you know, he's got to go out into the valley. He's got to leave where he is, a high place, move out towards the valley and go towards this garrison, which is located in a high place, this area where this garrison is. And so as he's going, being a military-minded guy, he's looking over strategic points where he's going to be able to maybe get the upper hand in a situation. And what he notices as he's heading towards this is that the passageway towards this garrison goes between these two sharp rocks. Obviously, they were important enough to make this a garrison post. This obviously was an obvious place where somebody would set up a lookout post. And so he's looking at that and realizing there's a narrow passageway into this area. And that would make a lot of sense for him to notice that, because that's an area where a few guys could take on a lot of guys, because a lot of guys are going to have to narrow down to just a few. And so conceivably, a guy could take guys on one at a time or two at a time and be able to get the upper hand. So we see right here that he's sizing this up. He's looking at the strategic places where small numbers could be effective, which is interesting as we think about his mindset in this. Verse 6, then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, come on, let's go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. Nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. So his armor bearer said to him, do all that's in your heart. Go then. Here I am with you, according to your heart. And Jonathan said, very well, let's cross over to these men and we'll show ourselves to them. And if they say thus to us, wait until we come to you, then we'll stand in our place and we won't go up to them. But if they say thus, come up to us, then we'll go up, for the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us. So, okay, this is where Jonathan, you know, this is where his boldness is just shining out. There's something wonderful about his character as we're looking at this. And we see where his hope is. You notice that he's not saying in this, you know, I think we could take him. I think we're strong enough and smart enough that we could work this out. And between you and me, I think we got something going on and we can take these guys out. But we see right here that he's not looking to his own strength to do something, but he's bold in his faith to ask God for help. You know, he's not looking to his own abilities, but he's definitely focusing on what the Lord may be up to. The circumstances that he's facing are bad. All of Israel are facing some very rough times right now in this situation. And so instead of just sitting around like his father is doing, kind of lamenting the situation, cursing his broken luck, he's actually looking for where the Lord may be at work. An important thing to remember, you know, a lot of times we're facing very, very difficult situations. A lot of times we've got the Philistines arrayed against us and the odds don't look so good and we're not exactly sure what to do next. And in those moments when we don't know what to do next, I think Jonathan's example is a great example of just kind of looking around, assessing the situation to see where the Lord may be at work. You know, one of the things that we've got to remember is that the Lord is never confused. The Lord's never taken by surprise. He doesn't, you know, he's not scared or wringing his hands or wondering what to do next. He's always at work. He's always at work. He's never idle or still. His work is always being done somewhere and in all things. And so our role in the situation is to not give in to the discouragement or that shock of inactivity that we fall into sometimes in bad situations. We need to start assessing the situation solution and look for not how we can cleverly get out of this, but look and see, where is the Lord at work in this? What's the Lord up to? What's he doing in this? And that's what Jonathan is doing here. And I love his statement in here, how he says that nothing I love that statement. Nothing restrains the Lord from using a few or using many. In other words, he's saying, you know, there's a lot of soldiers out there that we're facing. You know, we're going to stir up a hornet's nest. But nothing restrains the Lord from delivering us by just two of us or by a whole army of people. You know, the Lord doesn't care about numbers. You know, isn't that interesting? We get really obsessed about numbers, but God doesn't seem to care one way or the other. Jonathan's attitude was, hey, nothing restrains us. We can accomplish God's will no matter how few we are or no matter how many we are. I really love that there. You know, the circumstances and the empirical evidence dictated to Jonathan that he was woefully outmatched here. I mean, two guys against a garrison of people. That's just absurd odds there. But Jonathan's thoughts go outside of the box here. And I think that's such an important example for us when it comes to our relationship with God and how we navigate through the difficulties of this life. You know, his thoughts went to thinking about the nature of God, not thinking about the nature of the problem. You notice that? He doesn't sit there and he's not counting up. He's not sitting there with his armor bearer saying, now how many do you think you can take? I think I can take, you know, this many. Between the two of us, we could take at least this many of them. That's not even in his thought processes. He's not trying to figure out what they've got or what's going on in their camp or anything like that. He's thinking about the nature of God. He's waxing theological at this moment. He's starting to think about how God is powerful, and he says, nothing restrains God. Nothing restrains the Lord in this situation. There's nothing preventing him from doing what he wants to do. He'll do this through a handful. He'll do this through many. It really doesn't matter because he's God. He's the one who's in control of that. Nothing restrains the Lord. God plus one equals a majority in every situation. It doesn't matter how many are arrayed against us. It doesn't matter what kind of problems are arrayed against us. Paul reiterates this later on in Romans 8 when he says, if God be for us, who can be against us? If God be for us, if God has plainly declared, which he has through his word, that he cares about us, he loves us, he has a purpose and a plan in our lives, all things, all the circumstances of this life, he's working through them for our good. If we have those kind of promises, then who could possibly be against us? What could possibly be coming towards us that was going to overwhelm us or destroy us? It can't be done because God plus one makes a majority. If we're in harmony with the Creator, if we've come into relationship with him through Jesus Christ, if we're in a family relationship with God, God's not going to allow his family to be destroyed. Who can be against us? That's what Paul says. And I note here that John's perspective on this is good. It's not, you know, I can do great things. He's not saying to his armor bearer even, you know, you and I, we can do this. We can do great things and God will help us. You notice he's not putting it that way at all. His whole focus in this is about what the Lord can do. The Lord can do this. The Lord really can do this. And he could use us in the process of how he does this. And so he's making himself available to the Lord in what may be done here. You know, this is, I like this, you know, because even in this boldness of faith that Jonathan's expressing here, there's a humility that comes across. See, this is where, I diverge totally from those who teach, you know, what is commonly called the word of faith kind of message. It's, you know, it comes out of the charismatic circles where, and it was something that I was a part of, where you would go around and you would claim things, you know, and it was really supposed to be bold faith. You know, I'm going to claim this and this is going to happen. And in the process, what we ended up doing was turning everything around to where we were dictating to God. Here's how you're going to do this, God. You're going to do this and you're going to do that. And I'm going to sit back here and take the blessings as they roll in on me. And there was no humility associated with that. There was no humility in that at all. But Jonathan shows humility. Jonathan says, here's what the Lord could be doing. And you notice he's keeping it all in these abstracts. He's not being definitive exactly how this is going to be. He's keeping it in the abstracts. He's saying the Lord could do this and we could do it. You know, he could work through us to accomplish these things. So there's great humility that's expressed even while he's being bold in his faith. You know, it's so obviously this is a very compelling speech because his armor bearer is like all for it. Yeah, let's go do it. I'm with you, man. So, you know, it's kind of like a Henry V speech or something because it impresses his armor bearer. And so he comes up with this test, you know, and this is interesting because up to this point, Jonathan is acting on his own as far as we can tell. I mean, he's not been given, according to the text, he hasn't been given any kind of direct command from the Lord. It's not like the Lord came to him and said, Jonathan, I want you to go up and take this or anything like that. He's been sitting around, you know, he and his armor bearer are playing checkers or something. And finally he says, you know what, let's go scout around. Let's go see what's going on up there. And so they take off. And at this point, he has no clear direction from the Lord. He's just going out to see what's going on, to see where he can find where the Lord may be at work in this whole thing. And so he comes up with this test. And, you know, some have looked at that and said, well, here's where, you know, his faith was lacking a little bit, you know, and only certain types of teachers would say that anyway. But, you know, his faith was lacking and he shouldn't have, you know, come up with a test or anything like that. But I think it's the better part of wisdom. Again, he's seeking the Lord's direction in this. He hasn't been given a direct command from the Lord. Hey, you need to go do this. He's just moving out to see what may be up, where the Lord may be at work. And so he's showing some real flexibility here, which I think is a wonderful thing. You know, he doesn't put too much stake in his own plan. Again, showing that humility. You know, there are a lot of times in life that we're facing things and we don't know exactly what the Lord's will is. I mean, you know, it's a real pat answer for, you know, somebody in leadership or whatever to say, just go to the Word and the Word will guide you. Well, you know, you're trying to decide, should I sell my house? Okay, where is it? You know, it's not going to be there because we're going to have to rely on the Holy Spirit's direction and leading. And sometimes what happens to us is we can get so caught up in one direction or another. We can get caught up in this idea that, well, I'm not going to do anything until the Lord shows me. I'm not going to do anything until I know for sure that he's leading me into something and blah, blah, blah. And we don't do anything. We'll sit there and we'll sit there and do nothing. And we'll use the excuse that we're waiting on God to show us something and things will all fall apart and we haven't made one single move to better the situation. And we get religious, we'll wax religious and say, well, I was waiting on God, and so I don't know what to do. But there's another way that we can approach this too. And Augustine summed it up when he said, when trying to discern the will of the Lord, he said, love the Lord with all your heart, then do as you please. And some people freak out at a statement like that, but that's a very accurate statement. If we love the Lord our God with all of our heart, if we're really desiring to follow him, please him in all things, then certainly we can do as we please because we're going to be pleasing to do what's in harmony with his character. We're not going to go off and do our own thing at that point. So sometimes we have to step out. You know, the old adage that a ship sitting still in the water can't be turned. Its course can't be vectored. It's got to begin moving. Isn't that right, Captain? You got to begin moving, and then the ship can be turned and moved in a certain direction, one way or the other. So sometimes we have to move, just like Jonathan did here. He had to move towards his objective. He had to move out and begin looking around to see what was going on. But even when he moved out, it was important that he didn't stake all of his, you know, put too much stake in what he was doing at that moment. In other words, he didn't wrap his whole life and his whole ministry and his whole role as the king's son in this one decision. He didn't go out and say, well, this is it. I'm going to go out and do this and this is what God's going to do and how he's going to do it and stake everything in that. He was very flexible in the process of it. He moved in that direction saying, well, maybe the Lord will do this. And he put something out there as a sign. Lord, if you will guide me this way, if you will show me this way, then I'll be flexible. I'll do whatever. In other words, he was waiting. And depending on how they were going to respond to that, he was going to respond accordingly and recognize that the Lord was guiding him in the process of that. So there's a flexibility in that. Sometimes we just got to begin to move in a direction. We got to take a step towards something. Something's falling apart. Something has to be done. There's a time limit on it. Then assess the situation and do the best thing we know to do, but be flexible in the process so that as the Lord begins to reveal to us what it is that he wants us to do in the process, we can move with that and bend with that and change accordingly. That way we haven't, you know, put too much at stake in the process in terms of our own identity or our own spiritual identity. We're allowed to be flexible in that, be allowed to be moved by the Lord. I don't know if I'm making any sense. I'm just trying to explain. That's just like a little aside about life, but it's an example from Jonathan's experience here in discerning the will of the Lord, able to change his plans as were necessary. And so he put that sign out there to see how the Lord would guide them. Verse 11, so both of them showed themselves to the garrison the Philistines. So you kind of imagine that, you know, they jump off from behind a rock and go like that and jump back. And the Philistines said, look, the Hebrews are coming out of their holes where they've hidden. So obviously the word had gotten out. You know, remember how in the last time when this army assembled, everybody scattered and ran, they're jumping into cupboards and hiding in rabbit holes and all this kind of stuff. And so these guys are pointing that out. Said, oh yeah, the Hebrews are coming out of their hole. Verse 12, then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we'll show you something. Well, you know, obviously that's a threat. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me. The Lord's delivered them into the hand of Israel. So Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him. And they fell before Jonathan. And as he came after them, his armor bearer killed them. And that first slaughter, which Jonathan and his armor bearer made, was about 20 men within about a half an acre of land. So here we have this, you know, you can just, imagine the excitement of that. You know, can you imagine being out there? You've just told this to your armor bearer. You've just told him the way this is going to go down, that if they tell us to wait here, then we'll know that we're not supposed to do anything. We'll just wait back. We'll head on back. You know, the Lord's got other plans. But if they tell us to come up, we're going to take that as a sign that God's on our side and God's delivered them into our hands. And can you imagine how exciting that would be all of a sudden to be standing there and you realize they've just said the very thing that you've spoken in private to your armor bearer, to your comrade in arms, and you realize, man, this is it. The Lord's doing this. The Lord's going to deliver them into our hands. And so it says they're scrabbling up the cliff on their hands and knees. You know, it's a difficult climb. It's not real easy. They got to get up there, but they're not deterred by that obstacle. You know, you could easily see them looking at that and saying, you know, that's a tall cliff. I don't know, you know, I don't know if I want to get my pants dirty in the process of this. This is a hassle. Maybe we'll wait and see if they install an elevator or an escalator and we'll do it when it's a little more convenient. But no, you know, when he realizes this is the will of the Lord, man, nothing's going to stop him at that point. So he's climbing up this cliff, hands and knees, you know, climbing up there with his armor bearer behind them. And so the picture that we have of this then, obviously, is that it's a cliff that's going to lead towards this passageway. And this passageway is hemmed in by these rocks that leads out into a flat open space, about a half an acre of land, where this outpost is, a lookout point for the Philistines. So they clamber up this cliff and they get up there in between those two rocks, a place where the Philistines are going to have to come in on them in few numbers, you know, a couple at a time. And so even the way they describe it is that Jonathan is grabbing them, whacking them like this, and the shield bearer is dispatching them with his shield as they go. And then they just begin moving through there and they kill 20 guys. There was probably only 20 guys in the outpost. You know, it's a small little garrison up there, an outpost. It's a lookout station. The rest of the soldiers are going to be down in the camp in the main forces that are arrayed against Gilgal. Gibeah. I'll get those straight someday. Maybe, probably not. But, and so that's what they do. They go through and they destroy all of those guys. So that's how they're enabled. You know, the Lord works it out. And they're enabled to, as a small number of guys, to be able to take on this larger number of guys. And of course, you know, historians and other critics will look at this and just, you know, say, oh no, this is absolute mythology. It's an impossibility. Two guys could never have taken on this many guys, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that's absurd to dismiss that. I mean, again, we were given the geographical description there, which makes it actually quite plausible for a couple guys to be able to do something like that. Then factor in the idea that the Lord is behind this and the Lord is giving strength to them to do mighty things because their faith is in Him. I think it's highly offensive to dismiss that as being mythological or allegorical. I think it's quite literally, personally, that's the way I would take it. So, you know, they advance you there and they take on these guys. Okay, verse 15. Okay, so they, this is cool. They kill all these guys. Verse 15. And there was trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and the raiders also trembled, and the earth quaked, so that it was a very great trembling. Okay, so not only does Jonathan get up there, and he and his armor bearer, boom, 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 take on these guys, and you know, there's kind of an outcry. Maybe I'm sure that the guys in the garrison are calling out in ways to where the people in the camp are going to be aware that something's going on, and that's when God steps in and shakes things up. It's so cool to me. He gets in there and he begins this trembling movement, this fear that we're only can assume that this is something supernaturally imposed by the Lord himself, this fear that begins to rise up in them. You could imagine that maybe there are some natural causes for this because, well, they've suddenly been attacked by this small number of guys. This was completely unexpected. It's a rout up on top of the lookout point, and now something, you know, else is going on, and it's stirring people to a certain level of excitement and fear and confusion. But I still believe God's in the process of this and giving these people over to the natural born fears that they would have being part of a fallen world. And so, you know, it's just this wonderful thing, this miraculous thing. And it even says that the earth trembled. So that means that, okay, get the whole picture in your head. Jonathan, his armor bearer go up, bow, 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 take these guys out. Suddenly there's confusion. People are yelling and screaming. And then the earth begins to tremble underneath everybody. And you can imagine then, after they've heard up on the lookout point, the shouts of confusion and the screaming and maybe a couple bodies falling off the cliff at the same time. And they look up there and they're hearing all of this, and there's yelling and shouting going on in the camp, and everybody's starting to get confused, and they're running around in the pre-dawn hours, and suddenly, boom, the earth begins to shake and quake around them. And these guys are in pandemonium all of a sudden. The whole camp, this is probably the most details that we've ever gotten on how God went in there and screwed things up for people. But it's really cool. I love this. And so he leads them into this terrified state. The enemies of God's people are led into this terrified state of confusion, and they have no ability to carry out their plans of destroying whom God has determined to preserve. So verse 16, now the watchman of Saul in Geba of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away, and they went here and there. You know, so these guys are, you know, you got to imagine that. They've been looking up there for day after day, looking at this vast army. And you know, did you see Lord of the Rings? Do you remember Lord of the Rings at the, like in the second movie, when that big army's out in front of what's the name of the keep? Wherever they were. It doesn't matter. You understand what I'm talking about, you know. And you see that, and you've been watching that day after day, you know, watching this army out there, and it's menacing and it's scary, and you're watching the fires of their camp, and you're thinking about them coming in on you. And one day you're out there looking at it, and you're hearing all this shouting and this screaming, and you feel an earthquake, and suddenly you're watching this army just scatter out of nowhere, just going which away, every which away. Then verse 17, then Saul said to the people who were with him, now call the roll and see who has gone from us. And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. And Saul said to Ahiah, bring the ark of God here. For at that time, the ark of God was with the children of Israel. Now it happened while Saul talked to the priest that the noise which was in the camp of the Palestinians continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand. Okay, so here's the idea of what's going on here. You know, you see this, you know, they're watching this army dissipate before their eyes. The army that they were anticipating to come down and on and destroy them. And so the word gets back. You know, they send out word. You go tell Saul. The army's disbanding. Something's going on out there. We can hear shouting. We can hear it. Sounds like a fight's happening. Go let the king know. We got to figure out what to do next. And so they run down there. A runner comes up to Saul. You know, he's still sitting under the tree drinking a lemonade. And they tell him what's happening. And Saul, what a curious response from him. And again, we're getting disturbing insights into the character of this man. Instead of rising to his feet, like he did when the attack was coming on the children of Gad and rallying the people together, he jumps to his feet and says, let's get a head count of how many people we got that we can put together in the army. His first response, as opposed to just saying, gather everybody that we have and let's go, is to take a count. How many people we got? In fact, what he's doing, instead of recognizing that the Lord is up to something and beginning to move on his behalf and on behalf of the children of Israel, instead of recognizing that something is going on where the Lord is delivering the Palestinians into his hand, he begins assessing the situation according to his own natural understanding. How many guys we got here? Do we have enough to do this? I mean, God has already gone before them and begun to work this out. But, you know, obviously the word would have been coming back to him that the army is in disarray out there. They're running hither and thither. It's time to go out and take them. But instead of acting, Saul wants a roll call. He wants to find out who they have left in the army, who's still there. Quite a contrast to his son. I mean, his son, who in such bold faith is going out to see what the Lord is up to. And then when they take the roll call, everybody, you know, gathers up and they're going through and they get to the J's and Jonathan's not there. And so then they're looking around and, you know, everybody's really thinking about it. Where did Jonathan go? He's not even here with everybody. Saul seems to be panicking. Don't you kind of get that feeling from this as you read this text? You get the sense that he's just kind of, he doesn't know what to do next. Oh, well, let's find out how many guys we got. And then when Jonathan's not there, he's you know, the gears are turning and he's trying to figure out what to do. And so he calls for the ark. That is an odd thing. I mean, I find that really peculiar. That's a peculiar thing for him to do, to call for the ark. There's a lot of speculation on that. A lot of people trying to figure out why he would have done that. He was either trying to, you know, look spiritual in the process of this. You know, let's get the presence of the Lord in on this and make sure that, you know, he's here or working or whatever. But, you know, we only had to go back a couple chapters to find that section where the Israelites started looking at the ark like as if it was a good luck charm that they were going to take out with them into battle. And it was a terrible disaster. I mean, the thing fell apart. The ark got stolen. The Palestinians ruled them. And it was miserable. It was a terrible disaster when that happened. So it's hard to say. Maybe he did have it in the back of his mind that, you know, the ark did end up bringing a real curse on the Palestinians when they had it. But it's just a weird thing. You know, there's no real clear explanation as to why he would have done that. Whatever his motive was, though, he's definitely overstepping his bounds again. He's definitely going into realms where he's not supposed to go. He's supposed to assemble the army and go out there and attack the Palestinians at this point. But instead, he's trying to manipulate things on a religious level once again. He's trying to get the ark over here. And for whatever reason there, and it's a curious thing. When a person's heart isn't right like that, how they do have a tendency to get religious instead of drawing close to God like they need to. Instead of calling out to the Lord, instead of calling out and repenting or whatever, he begins doing as many religious things as he possibly can do on a flurry of activity here. And then it says, you know, he's calling for the priest and the camp, the noise in the Palestinian camp is growing louder and louder. So obviously the situation is really falling apart out there in the valley to where they're even hearing it in town. You know, it's carrying across the fields and they're hearing the sound of men shouting and whatnot. And so, then Saul says, when he realizes, you know, this is time for activity, something's got to happen, it's time to take the men out. He says to the priest, withdraw your hand. Confusing thing to say. But most scholars believe that what he's saying here is that the priest was in the process of reaching for the Urim and Thummim to cast lots to get the mind of the Lord on that, which is the way they would have kept in a compartment on the breastplate of the ephod that they would have worn. So he would have been reaching for that, and Saul would be saying to him, withdraw your hand, don't bog down with this. We're not going to mess with talking to God about this now. All of these things, there's a strange out of sync, out of step sense to Saul at this point. He's saying, oh, no, we're not going to mess with God. We can't worry about that. Let's just get everybody together. Let's go out there. There's an impotent, an impudence, not rightness to what he's doing there. And so he decides it's time for action. Verse 20. Then Saul said to all the people who were with him assembled. He didn't say anything. I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know what I'm reading. Then Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to battle, and indeed every man's sword was against his neighbor. He's talking about the Palestinians. That's what's going on in there. And there was a very great confusion. So they get out there in the field. He marches all the guys out there, and they're heading out, and, you know, I'm sure there's great trepidation in all the soldiers, especially the ones carrying, you know, garden hose and shovels and stuff. And they're heading out there, and Saul's got his sword, and they're marching up there. But as they get closer and closer and they're looking and they're thinking, yeah, there's a battle going on, but these guys are fighting each other. This is really weird, you know, and everybody's scattering and running and spears are flying and arrows are going and running around on fire and all kinds of things. And it's quite a scene, I'm sure, that was upon them. You know, they're already fighting against each other. Verse 21, moreover, the Hebrews who were with the Palestinians before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Well, now there's an interesting detail that we hadn't had before. there's the Palestinians are arrayed in battle array against the Israelites, and there's a bunch of Israelites in there with them, Hebrews that are with them. Now, this could either be that these guys were traitors, guys who looked at the odds and said, well, there's no way that we're going to get involved in this fight unless we're on the winning side, and so we're going to join with you. We like the Palestinians. Let's go. It could be that. They could be traitors in this, or they could be conscripts, because that's not unheard of. The conquering army that comes through gathers up the men from there and saying, you're fighting with us. You know, well, we don't want to. You don't want to? You want to die? Well, no, now that I think about it, I would like to fight with you. So, you know, you got conscripts out there that are there against their own will. And you did, again, it's movie reference time, but you remember Braveheart? Do you remember the movie Braveheart? Do you remember when the Irish guys were, the guy says, my island, you know, and he's saying that, you know, don't worry about the Irish people when they come out. And so when the Irish guys came out and they're racing towards each other, like that, and then they stop in the middle of the field and they're shaking hands and stuff. Well, the same thing happens here. Suddenly the band are running out towards them and they're going, okay, guys, here we go. And they get closer and closer and the guys go, hey, you know, la, 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 la. And they, you know, because they're all in on it together. And so then they turn against the Palestinians. So you got this incredible confusion of battle that has developed here. What went from insurmountable, unbelievable odds has turned into this amazing rout of confusion and the dynamic of God at work in all of this, orchestrating earthquakes and causing men to fall prey to the natural fears that they're prone to in a fallen world like this. So verse 22, likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard that the Palestinians fled, they also followed hard after them in battle. So you got all the guys who are hiding in the, you know, in the cupboards and in the bushes and stuff. And when they see that, you know, that everybody's running, they go, well, that's easy. And they jump out and they run out. And so they're joining in and they're running along and saying, hey, when did you get here? Oh, I've been here all along. What do you mean? And, you know, and so they run into battle with them. So now the odds are suddenly beginning to shift. So, you know, you've got the Palestinians whose army was compact and tight and chariots and tanks and rocket launchers and everything else like that. It's all spread out and everybody's running which way. And now the Hebrews all of a sudden are coming together in unity. All the ones that were, you know, you had the guys that were holding out back in the camp with Saul. You had the guys that were selling out who were there with the Palestinians for whatever reason. They were in the enemy's camp. They've come out of the enemy's camp. And you had all the guys who were hiding out, who were trying to avoid this conflict, have now come out into the open. And God, by his power, when he showed his strength, is bringing everything back into unity. You've got the brothers dwelling together in unity. And now great things are afoot. Now, all of a sudden, moving together under the hand of the Lord and the direction of the Lord, this amazing little band of backwards guys who didn't even have the benefits of the Iron Age with them are routing this superpower that was arrayed before them. God took circumstances that seemed absolutely insurmountable, odds that were inescapably bad for the Israelites, and turned it all upside down, and by his power turned it into a situation where now Israel has the upper hand and calls the shots here. Verse 23, so the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle shifted to Beit Aven. And so Josephus, in his retelling of this, says that the tradition is that 6,000 Palestinians died that day. So the Lord obviously gave them a great victory. And what started it all? What started this change of events? You know, they were sitting there and it was a terrible sense of dread over what was going to happen, how bad the circumstances had gotten. But one guy decided to be bold in the Lord, to go out and see where the Lord was at work. And in his search, in his quest, to look around and look at circumstances and see what God was up to, he found a way in which he could be a part of God's plan and be used by the Lord to bring about a change. And so when he yielded himself to God's work and God's ways, God took everything and turned it around, so that now Israel has been delivered. So here's a great example of Jonathan's bold and yet humble at the same time faith that he had before the Lord, something we can aspire to as followers of God, something that we can learn from, to follow him, to believe in him, to realize that nothing restrains him in all of these situations and circumstances that we face. It's just a matter of finding where he's at work, not dictating to him and telling him what he's going to do, but finding out what he's up to and being bold enough and nutty enough to believe him that he'll actually work through us to make a difference in the world. Right? How cool. All right. Well, listen, as we close tonight, one thing I really want to do, let's just begin here. I want to pray for Brenda Rutherford and her family. As many of you know, her brother...